Good morning, Brew Daily Show. I'm Neil Fryman.
And I'm Toby Howell.
Today, would Google really make you pay for search? It's certainly possible in the age of AI.
Then you'll hear how Taiwan was able to weather a powerful earthquake while keeping its critical semiconductor infrastructure up and running. It's Friday, April 5th. Let's ride. Neil, after 2 weeks, hundreds of thousands of votes in some contentious debate, you all have finally answered the question, what is the greatest invention of all time? To catch you up to speed, we put together a March Madness-style bracket where we pitted 64 inventions against each other to crown a GOAT greatest invention of all time. Our championship wrapped up today, and in the heavyweight matchup of fire versus electricity, electricity came out on top.
Electricity, greatest invention of all time, according to our audience. Makes sense because electricity has enabled a lot of other inventions, but its eligibility was also questioned because electricity, as anyone who's seen lightning knows, humans didn't actually invent it. It does occur in nature. We just harnessed it, which, you know, I think we as the selection committee, we said that was fine, but I totally understand the questions. Still, I think it is a wake-up call that we need to host a MBD camping trip. Get away from this plugged-in life a little bit.
Get off the grid a little bit. Yeah, there were a ton of upsets in our bracket. All the number one seeds, fire, electricity, the wheel, and the internet made it to the final four, which just means that the selection committee did its job.
Such a good job.
But this was fun. Thank you to everyone who participated. That ran on our Morning Brew socials over the last 2 weeks. And it's just a fun thing that we do every March Madness. Now let's hear a word from our friends over at Robinhood. Today, I want to tell you about Robinhood Gold, Robinhood's premium tier, and it feels premium, all right.
Longtime listeners know that Toby and I have talked about how high yields are these days. Well, Robinhood Gold is offering a whopping 5% annual percentage yield on uninvested cash.
Your first 30 days of Robinhood Gold are free, then you can subscribe for as little as $5 a month, which the 5% yield can eventually cover.
They just announced a gold credit card with 3% cash back across all categories, terms apply. Of course. Plus, Robinhood Gold offers larger instant deposits up to $50,000 a day and access to research tools from Morningstar.
All for less than the cost of your venti cup of coffee.
Learn more about the free app in the App Store or Google Play Store. Disclosures: investing involves risk. Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC. There are three things certain in life: death, taxes, and not paying for Google search. But the third one's more uncertain now after reports that Google is considering charging users for AI-powered features on search. If it happens, it'd be the biggest shakeup to its business model ever and send shockwaves across the tech industry. So why would Google do this? It's because AI is insanely expensive, far more than traditional search due to the massive amounts of computing required. And as loaded as Google is, it still needs to recoup the cost of running AI systems somehow, especially at the scale search is operating on. Plus, its bread and butter advertising model might not be such a sure bet anymore. Generative AI chatbots from OpenAI or Jeff Bezos-backed Perplexity gives you full answers to your questions instead of a list of links like Google does. That instantaneous feedback has been alarming Google ever since ChatGPT rolled out a year and a half ago. Toby, nothing is set in stone, but every other AI company has a subscription tier for their chatbots. How can Google avoid doing that?
Yeah, this would be a seismic shift for Google's business model, which has long just relied on advertising, but it's also causing Google to have maybe a little existential crisis because these search engines that provide those more complete AI-generated answers, you mentioned Perplexity, that no longer require users to kind of sift through these big links that are linked to advertisers' websites, that is a threat to Google's very core of how it monetizes. So not only do I think that Google is trying to figure out how it can afford to recoup its investment in this AI, but they're also trying to figure out if their business model, their search business model, still plays in this new AI.
It definitely is an existential crisis. Google made $175 billion in revenue just from search and related ads last year. That's more than half of its total sales. But if you are going to invest in AI, which Google is doing because you need to do that to juice your stock price or else you're going to get left behind by all the other tech companies, then you need to add revenue because those cost so much much. We talked about how much data centers all these tech companies are building. Those aren't cheap. Just last week, OpenAI and Microsoft announced plans to build a $100 billion data center. Mark Zuckerberg at Meta is spending $9 billion just on NVIDIA GPUs alone. Amazon announced that a single training model that it ran cost $65 million. So this is an extremely expensive investment, and Google, if it wants to keep investing in this, is going to need to charge users, it feels like.
The other even more valuable resources than even GPUs from NVIDIA are actually talent, because there's this massive talent war going on in the AI space right now. OpenAI's former head of developer relations, who left OpenAI in March, just announced this week that he was joining Google, and big tech is just poaching talent left and right. Remember, Amazon increased its stake in Anthropic by $2.75 billion last week. Apple has been quietly buying up these AI startups. Microsoft obviously has OpenAI. It also did this weird acqui-hire of a company called Inflection, where they paid the startup $650 million to license its AI model. But really, everyone knew they just wanted to hire most of its employees. So we're seeing these crazy things happening right now. There's rumors that Mark Zuckerberg is penning these heartfelt emails to try to woo potential recruits to come over to Meta. So we are seeing a talent war unlike we've seen in a very long time.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. Elon Musk said, he said very forthright that he was raising compensation for artificial intelligence workers at Tesla because OpenAI was coming to poach them. He said it was a craziest talent war I've ever seen. So you're right. This is like a huge resource for companies, not just data centers, not just GPUs, but the actual humans behind the artificial intelligence boom. While we're on the subject of Google, there were reports yesterday that it is looking to possibly buy HubSpot, the marketing software company, which has a market value of $35 billion. So any acquisition would be probably more than that. And that would mean that this would be Google's biggest acquisition ever.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I'm going to say it one more time. What do you do when you go through a midlife crisis? You start buying a lot of expensive things, and HubSpot would be Google's biggest acquisition of all time. Earlier this week, Taiwan experienced a powerful magnitude 7.4 earthquake that shook the island, injuring thousands and killing 10. Though the quake was strong and more than 300 aftershocks coursed through the island over the next 24 hours, structures on the island stood remarkably firm. One director at Northeastern's Global Resilience Institute said similar level earthquakes in other societies have killed far more people, underscoring just how uniquely prepared Taiwan was for such a natural disaster. A combination of improvements in building codes, wide-scale public awareness, and a highly trained search and rescue force reduced the destructive force of the quake to a minimum, which was especially good news for the semiconductor industry that relies heavily on Taiwan and TSMC to manufacture its delicate silicon wafers. Despite losing a few wafers to the tremor, the company said overall impact to its operations were minimal, and they were quickly making up for lost time. Neil, of all the places for an earthquake to impact, Taiwan was somehow both the most prepared and the most vulnerable when it comes to its role in the global supply chain.
Yeah, it was definitely one of those moments, kind of like the Ever Given in the Suez Canal and attacks on ships in the Red Sea, where everyone looks at these bottlenecks in the global supply chain, and we realize just how fragile it is because there are these choke points, there are these points of concentration for the semiconductor industry, which is extremely important to the global economy. Taiwan is that most critical single point of failure because they have established over the past few decades one of the most amazing semiconductor industries around. I mean, they do dominate the industry, especially for the highest end chips. So they produce 80% to 90% of the highest end chips there that companies like we just talked about, all of the AI companies and NVIDIA use for AI. And so it's a Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company is the largest company there. It's the ninth most valuable company in the world. So when you look at just the physical, how our global economy kind of sits on these fault lines, so to speak.
Yeah, metaphorically and physically. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because you're right, TSMC has invested a lot of money in specifically earthquake-proofing its operations because manufacturing semiconductors is an incredibly precise process that can be thrown off by even the slightest vibrations. And here they are, where a lot of their factories are situated on literal fault lines. So it is something that you have to think about. Taiwan in general too is just amazing what they've done to their city to almost earthquake proof it. I want to talk about Taipei 101, which was once the tallest building in the world. It's 1,670 feet tall, and it has this 703-ton steel ball hanging between the 88th and 92 floors. This ball acts as this dampener system, which reduces the sway of a building up to 40% during an earthquake. It is wild to see in action. You can literally, they have a cutout within the building that you can go and observe this massive ball. There are videos of it online of it swaying as it's offsetting the movement of the building. Just a very cool piece of structural engineering that kind of makes me wish I went into the structural engineering field.
And they've turned it into a tourist attraction, so good for them. But no, the concentration of semiconductors in Taiwan is really worrying to observers, especially as China maybe threatens to invade their. Bloomberg Economics estimates that a war over Taiwan would cost the global economy $10 trillion, which dwarfs the cost of the COVID pandemic and the global financial crisis. Solar panels have become so cheap in some European countries that people are using them as fencing for their gardens. Sure, they're not angled efficiently to capture the sun's rays, but at this point, panels are like those free t-shirts you get freshman year of college. They're just so many, you throw them anywhere you have space. And this isn't just a funny anecdote. It actually touches on one of the most significant geopolitical conflicts of our age, which is China's dominance as a producer of green technology. The reason solar panels are so cheap is because China is cranking them out in extraordinary volumes, creating a glut that has driven prices down by half in the last year alone. China produces 80% of the world's solar panels, and it also makes about two-thirds of the globe's electric vehicles, wind turbines, and lithium-ion batteries. China's stranglehold of climate tech production, or overproduction if you want to call it that, is raising major alarm bells in Europe and the United States, who believe that domestic manufacturers are going to go out of business with all these cheap products coming in from China and undercutting them on price. Toby, we could be looking at Trade War 2.0 Climate Edition.
Yeah, welcome to the solar coaster, Neil, where for years, all we were trying to do is get the industry to adopt more solar, ramp up production, and now we're concerned with overcapacity issues. Solar panel supply globally will reach three times the present forecast for demand. So we have, again, this massive oversupply glut, which is not words that I thought we'd be saying about a green energy source anytime soon. But at the same time, installations have become more expensive. So even though the physical solar panels are cratering in price, there is rising labor costs associated with them. So a lot of these solar panels are just sitting in factories or being used as the much less intensive gardening fences that we are seeing across Europe right now. So it is interesting to see these massive imbalance between the labor, the cost, and the cost to produce these things.
And it's all because of China and how much they're making. And it's this really interesting tension between, it's amazing that we have cheap green tech technology. We've been wanting that forever to create cheaper solar panels so we can move from a carbon economy to renewable energy economy. The problem also is that China is making them, and the West, Europe, and the US are saying we do not want China to keep flooding our markets with these cheap products, because then we don't have a manufacturing base of our own to make electric vehicles, to make batteries, to make solar panels. And so there is a distinct prospect that there are going to be more tariffs, more trade barriers coming to stop the flow of cheap Chinese goods that are coming from China over to the West. And we've seen this many times before in many other industries. Steel is one thing that comes to mind, where the U.S. imposed tariffs on steel, Chinese steel, because they accused China of dumping them on their shores.
Right. And we've spoken a lot about Europe, but this is also an issue affecting the U.S. a lot, because solar power manufacturers are getting subsidies in the U.S. Of under that $369 billion Inflation Reduction Act, but still those imports from Asia are coming in at discounts to U.S.-made stuff. So even when accounting for the tariffs we apply to those imports, even when accounting to the subsidies we're giving domestic manufacturers, so you're right, it is just completely undercutting the industry, and the U.S. and Europe want to protect their own domestic industries. Up next, you get to hear Neil and I talk stocks in our Stock of the Week, Dog of the Week segment.
Here at the Morning Brew Daily Show, we know a thing or two about daily rituals.
Daily coffee, daily run, daily hour with hair and makeup.
And Sunbum is a very fitting addition to any routine, especially with their new aptly named Daily line, which makes having good days daily a little bit easier.
With 24-hour hydration, it's sunscreen that doesn't feel like sunscreen. It's not seasonal or vacation-based. Sunbum's Daily line is a sun care and skin care hybrid.
From their translucent matte formula daily gel to their body lotion that mimics a morning body lotion with added SPF 50, there's a sunscreen for every routine.
Ready to add some to yours? Head to sunbum.com/morningbrew and use code BREW15 for 15% off the daily collection. That's sunbum.com/morningbrew with code BREW15.
Let's be honest, hiring is hard. But you know what might be harder?
Getting hired?
Exactly. Thankfully, Express Employment Professionals makes both a whole lot easier. Express strikes this ideal balance because they have roots with local networks and resources from their international headquarters. They'll take care of the most taxing parts of the hiring process, saving you time and money while finding you the right people.
On the flip side, Express connects job seekers with dozens of local companies with just one application.
Just think about that for a minute. One application connects you to endless opportunities.
As any job seeker knows, that's a huge time saver.
Let the pros at Express make your search easier. Head over to expresspros.com to get started.
You know what time it is. Stock of the week, dog of the week time, where Neil and I tell you about one stock that thinks the latest season of Curb Your Enthusiasm is good and one stock that thinks it's bad. Neil, since you are the one with the bad curb take and you lost the pre-show game of pesto making, I'm up first and my stock of the week is Spotify. Spotify is raising prices again and investors are loving it. It's jacking up prices by about $1 to $2 a month in most of its major markets by the end of April, with a U.S. bump coming later this year. The higher prices will go towards covering the cost of audiobooks, something that Spotify recently added into its offerings this past year. The addition of audiobooks means it's reshuffling its tiers a little bit too. It's bringing in a new basic tier that will offer music and podcasts, let's freaking go, but not audiobooks for $11 a month. On the other end of the spectrum, Spotify is still cooking up a super premium plan, which would give customers access to high fidelity, aka hi-fi audio, which has long been anticipated. Overall, despite the price changes last year, Spotify posted its best year of user growth ever with 113 million new signups to its free and paid plan, and is no doubt hoping customers will be equally price insensitive this time around. Neil, stock is up 14% in the last week. It's flying high right now.
It is. I mean, Spotify is on the road to profitability, which it has not been. It's lost money every single year since it went public in 2018. It has a huge cost base because it has to pay musicians royalties for every time a song of theirs is streamed. That accounts for 70% of its revenue. So for every $10 that comes in, it has to pay $7 out. And so that creates not the most profitable business model. It thinks audiobooks and these other audio categories will allow it to become a higher margin business that will eventually lead to profitability. It is interesting that it's banking its future, at least in part, on audiobooks, because people will have to pay. If you don't want audiobooks, you can stay on this particular price point. But if you do, you can opt into that higher tier. We'll see how many people convert.
Right. Investors have definitely been looking to Spotify to diversify its revenue streams from these things where you have to pay out seven of every $10 you generate to music artists. So it went all in on podcasts. That was kind of its famous push into podcasts that didn't go so well. It did say its podcast will turn a profit this year, but it's already sunk billions of dollars into its podcasting approach. The big difference between Spotify's approach to audiobooks and the market leader Amazon's right now, Audible, which is owned by Amazon, makes you pay for almost every individual book you buy, whereas Spotify customers will get a little taste of audiobooks, 15 hours a month for free, have that limited access, or you can buy the plan and get access to its audiobook. So it is a little bit different in terms of the approaches that the current market leader is taking and then how Spotify hopes to kind of chip away at what Audible has built up.
Yeah, it does seem to be at this point that Spotify does have a decent amount of pricing power. Okay, my dog of the week is Ulta, the beauty store chain, whose epic run seems to have run out of steam. Its stock is down 13% this week after its CEO warned that slower growth is coming, and it's coming faster than anyone expected. Ever since COVID started, the cosmetics and beauty industry had defied gravity. People just couldn't get enough skincare and makeup during the pandemic, after the pandemic, in the face of soaring inflation. It didn't matter. Last year, it was the fastest growing category in all of U.S. retail, with consumers shelling out $94 billion to look and smell nice. But there's only one Cal Ripken, and the beauty boom seems to be losing some juice. Ulta's CEO said that higher credit card debt and the return of student loan payments were putting the squeeze on consumers, and as a result, Ulta's sales. The question now is this a short-term blip on the road to new heights, or is beauty set for a longer-term slowdown?
I tell you, one industry that is really watching with apprehension right now is the physical retail world, because a lot of these big box retailers have invested a lot into the makeup boom, the cosmetic boom. Target has opened Ulta shops in a lot of its stores. Kohl's plans to open Sephora shops in all of its locations. Macy's also doubling down on its beauty chain, Blue Mercury. So if we're seeing this beauty market that has seemed almost unimpeachable, it's been this unstoppable force that has rolled through all sorts of economic hardship, if we finally start seeing this downturn as retail is embracing it, it could get ugly for a lot of different industries.
That is a great point. And beauty is one of those consumer retail sectors that people pay attention to maybe more than its actual dollar amount may be worth. And that's because of what's called the lipstick index. And it was created in 2001 by Leonard Lauder, one of the heirs to the Estee Lauder fortune. And he found that during times of economic hardship, people bought more lipstick. And it was a sign that even during recessions, people would shell out for these affordable luxuries to treat themselves. So now that lipstick sales are going down, what does that say about our economy? That we're doing well?
Yeah, I think so.
We just discount the lipstick index completely?
Right. I don't know.
It's never been proven.
We're going to have to check in with hair and makeup and see what their thoughts are. I'm surprised you didn't loop a hair and makeup joke in there. So I had to get one.
All right. One of the world's most popular TV shows could be ending its run just as it was ramping up global domination. That show is about a family of anthropomorphic Australian blue heeler dogs. And all the young parents listening know exactly what show I'm talking about. It's Bluey. Bluey will wrap up its third season next Sunday, and the team has been mysteriously silent about whether there will be a fourth. Speculation is rampant that the episode will see the family move houses, which is unheard of in an animated series. Have the Simpsons ever moved out of their house? No, which is why there's huge concern that moving trucks might signal the end of the show. And if Bluey did end, it'd be like Michael Jordan leaving basketball for baseball at his peak performance. Bluey wasn't just the most watched kids show last year. It was the second most streamed show overall behind Suits. Americans watched 731 million hours of Bluey in 2023, more than NCIS, Grey's Anatomy, and even Friends. All those eyeballs have spawned an entertainment empire that puts Bluey's valuation at around $2 billion. More like Louis Vuitton, am I right?
You are so right. One generation had Snoopy. For this generation, there is Bluey. It is just an absolute juggernaut. And one of the reasons it's a juggernaut is because parents will tell you it is good. They genuinely like the show. There was this big Bloomberg profile of it that said Bluey was conceived by a genuine author in the mold of Donald Glover's Atlanta or Jesse Armstrong's Succession, literally comparing this TV show that runs episodes that are 7 minutes long to Succession is interesting, but it really does go to show you that this approach that Bluey took towards children's content is resonating not only with the kids, not only with the dogs that end up watching the show, but with parents themselves.
Oh yeah, my friends say who have little kids say they love it. It's a remarkable show. Let's talk about who's making money and who's not making money from Bluey. Well, one company that could be making a lot more is Disney. Disney had the opportunity to license the consumer products division of Bluey and its merchandise and its theme parks, but it declined to do so. It just sort of bought the broadcasting rights, and that was actually huge for Disney+. Bluey debuted in 2018. Disney Plus debuted in 2019, and during the pandemic, Bluey really carried Disney Plus. It accounted, just last quarter, it accounted for 29% of all Disney Plus viewing hours. So there is a lot of speculation that Disney whiffed maybe the first time in seeing the potential of Bluey, and it may come back, albeit at a much higher price point, to buy Bluey, because there is a lot of synergy with Bluey and Disney.
Absolutely. That 29% stat is excluding the movies on the platform, but still, it is just goes to show you how big of a presence Bluey is on Disney. U.S. networks were interested. Nickelodeon kind of was interested early on when Bluey was first rising, but they decided to pass because they already had Blue's Clues, which is another anthropomorphic blue dog. So it is interesting to see the cultural impact this has had. And yeah, it's kind of been this get out of jail free card for Disney Plus. Of all the shows that it invested in, Bluey seems to have supported it. And in Bob Iger's transition to try to get the streaming division to make money, I could definitely see a world in which Disney buys Bluey in the coming months or coming years.
But the Bluey creator, Joe Blum, who's this Australian, we should say all of these dogs have
They're all Australian.
He didn't even want to make a second season because he's very guarded about the content. But it would just be the most epic mic drop ever to just say, three seasons, I'm out.
Even better than Seinfeld, which stopped before it was... Didn't Seinfeld stop before it,
no.
It went on too long? Oh, I thought that was...
No, it was already on its way down in season nine.
For our final story of the day, we're checking in on Botswana President Masisi, who is threatening to send 20,000 elephants to Germany, which has already been inducted into the MBD Hall of Fame for the craziest lead-in to a story. The background here is that the Environmental Ministry in Germany is seeking to ban the import of trophy animals due to poaching concerns, which on the surface seems like a good thing, but it's more complicated than that. Botswana is struggling with an elephant overpopulation problem. According to Masisi, Botswana's elephant population has grown to around 130,000 as conservation efforts have allowed the species to absolutely thrive. So to tackle the issue, it's offered 8,000 elephants to nearby Angola, 500 to Mozambique, and now 20,000 to Germany. Though something tells me this one is a little bit more tongue-in-cheek. There is a long-running tension between Western moral opposition to hunting and African countries that feel it's necessary both for economic and conservation reasons. So while this disconnect has produced some interesting headlines, this really is a debate that has to be had.
It's a big issue. I mean, think about how many elephants 130,000 is. These are big creatures. They're causing all sorts of havoc in Botswana, which is home to a third of the entire globe's population of elephants. And if Germany blocks the import of these trophies, then it could hurt Botswana's economy. They did ban this practice in 2014 until 2019, and a 2017 paper found that it did hurt local economies. It reduced jobs in the area. So you can see why the Botswana leadership is saying, Germany, you don't know what's going on the ground here. We have an elephant infestation, in a sense, and we need you to come and take some off our hands. It's not a population control thing. Germany just imported 26 elephant trophies last year. It's not going to meaningfully reduce the population, but by bringing jobs, but by bringing economic development, it could lead to better population control efforts by Botswana.
Right. Animal rights advocates on kind of the European side say killing animals for sport is wrong. Sport hunting by tourists will actually increase the likelihood of extinction events for certain animal species, but trophy hunters and also some more of the more pragmatic conservationists say, as long as trophy hunting remains controlled, which it is a controlled industry, it has more financial benefits for the local community. Plus, it does help a little bit with population control. You are right, though, that 26 licensed to import those trophies does pales in comparison to the sheer amount of animals there are. And then just to be clear, trophy hunting is a regulated industry, unlike poaching, which is illegal. So do not conflate the two things. And that's what Botswana's president also wants to put forth, that we're not encouraging poaching. We're encouraging legal hunting practices.
All right. Enough elephant talk. Let's wrap it up there for the week. Thanks so much for listening, and happy Friday to everyone who celebrates. Did you know a new survey found that the average American worker clocks out on Friday at 4:03 p.m., which is a full hour earlier than they did last year? Hope you find yourself in that position today. The inbox has been full of wonderful notes recently, so keep them coming to Morning Brew Daily at morningbrew.com. Let's roll the credits. Emily Milliron is our executive producer. Raymond Liu is our producer. Olivia Graham is our associate producer. Uchenna Ogu is our technical director. Billy Menino is on audio. Hair and makeup is not loving this beauty slowdown. Devin Emery is our chief content officer, and our show is a production of Morning Brew.
Great show today, Neil. I wish you well.